You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
It's Tuesday, April 30th, and calling the cops isn't the only threat a school can make. We start here.
Disclosure, amnesty.
Columbia University starts issuing mass suspensions of students camped out on campus.
You're seeing these consequences that certainly could follow these students for quite some time.
But these protests aren't going anywhere, so what's next for colleges nationwide? Former President Trump heads back to court.
This is the paper trail that prosecutors need to get into the record.
This is now likely the only trial he'll face before Election Day, so what are jurors hearing? And what has ball players so uniformly annoyed?
We're not talking about portrait gallery oil paintings here.
Why Nike is being shredded for its design. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Think back to 4 years ago, spring 2020. High school seniors around the country are realizing, oh no, this pandemic that just shut down in-person classes a few weeks ago isn't ending anytime soon. Our graduation ceremonies will be virtual. Many of those high schoolers went to college, but again, many of those classes were online. Well now, members of that class, the class of 2024, are finally about to get their college degrees. But some are being told that now their college commencements might not be happening in person this year, this time because of protests rocking their college campuses.
Pessa, you will rise. Students are by your side.
There is like a level of frustration. For us, it's kind of inconvenient to have the campus closed and to not be able to get to certain places. So
yeah. And I think a lot of the students are really disappointed in the response because the protest was intentionally peaceful.
This is the dilemma gripping schools from Columbia in New York to UT Austin to USC in California as they face growing protests over the war in Gaza. Because at this point, it's clear that inviting police on campus can escalate things even further. So yesterday at Columbia, students faced a different kind of threat. Give up your encampment or potentially give up your position as a student here. It's the latest in a series of ultimatums from universities and local authorities. Let's go to ABC's Trevor Ault, who's been covering this on each coast. Trevor, what's happening?
You see the steady drumbeat, Brad, every single day of escalation, 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 some from the side of the encampments and the growing crowds there, some from the law enforcement response to it. I mean, yesterday we saw riot police at the University of Texas at Austin. Despite the fact that you have already seen 1,000 arrests since these demonstrations began, I mean, we were 200 arrests this weekend alone, Brad. You're only seeing a hardened resolve from a lot of these demonstrators. Although maybe at Columbia, we might be getting some of the firmest consequences so far, or at least consequences that could end up derailing the futures for a lot of these demonstrators. And Columbia is really the face of this movement. It has been since the very beginning with that first encampment. It was also one of the only universities where they were publicly negotiating with the protesters, trying to reach some kind of solution. And it doesn't appear, Brad, like they were able to find one. If anything, it maybe bought a little bit more time. But Columbia yesterday essentially put down that firm deadline. They didn't move at this time. 2 p.m. Monday, you need to leave or you're going to face suspension. That means suspension from the university. It also means suspensions for some members of the faculty, depending on what they're saying, too.
Columbia's threats distributed through flyers are reminiscent of the flyers the Israeli army launches from the sky to Gazans.
There are a lot of students in this encampment. A suspension would have some serious long-lasting consequences. The university also tells them, hey, by the way, while you're leaving, you're going to need to sign your name indicating you were here. They say that they've already taken note of a lot of the students who were there. Whether or not they have all of them, not really sure, but it could be seen by some of these demonstrators as essentially admitting that they were there. Mm. Still then, 2 o'clock rolls around, Brad, and a whole lot of these students are still there.
This encampment is a minor inconvenience compared to the generational shaping events taking place now in Gaza.
And out came the suspensions. They are continuing to roll it. The vice president of the university continues to talk about how they're suspending more and more students and that they're going to find out everybody who is there. This has stretched now for weeks, Brad, and you're seeing these consequences that certainly could follow these students for quite some time.
Which is why I suppose you see so many of these students wearing masks on campus. Like, that's become a real part of this kind of face covering thing on campus. Trevor, if I was a university president at this point, I would have to ask myself the question, can we please just get through to the end of the semester? Because you got to imagine when summer hits, students go home, temperature probably cools down. I mean, what is the thought process from school administrators right now?
Yeah, I mean, I'm... certainly, Brad, the concept of, well, can we just find a quiet little solution to get us to the summer that doesn't make anybody mad? That ship has sailed right. A long time ago. At this point, whatever they're going to do, there's going to be a lot of people paying attention to it, and there's going to be a lot of people angry. And they really are in a tricky position of having to navigate those waters because on top of just dealing with the idea of the encampment and how that impact is going to play out on students of all kinds. Because remember, this is not like every single student that goes to the school is staying out on the lawn, but it is quite disruptive. I mean, that is the point of the protest, is to disrupt the status quo. You have these commencement speeches that are scheduled where thousands of people are coming in. It's a celebration of everything that your university holds dear. And Brad, tomorrow is the day where incoming students need to officially decide where they're going to be going to school for next year. They've got all that hanging in the balance too. Now, we've seen a lot of different ways of handling it. Besides Columbia trying to negotiate with the encampment, now doling out the suspensions. I mean, even with the commencement speeches, USC outright canceled their main event. That's something that 65,000 people go to on a year-to-year basis. They said they had to do it because of safety. Columbia, on the other hand, is essentially saying, hey, we need this space because we're going to do commencement. They are basically promising to everyone that commencement is going to happen one way or another. Whether or not they're going to be able to make that happen or when they're going to make that happen is certainly hanging in the balance. The president said they're not going to divest from any Israeli interest, as the students had demanded. And then, of course, you have the minutiae of how you're handling the suspensions, how you're handling the allegations of anti-Semitism from some members of your community or from other students that go to your university. And let's not forget, Brad, we're only a couple months removed from when several presidents of extremely prominent universities were called before Congress to testify of their handling of anti-Semitism, and then they lost their jobs.
Specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
If it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So it's not just the fact that they have to protect their university and all their traditions and try to keep people safe. Their jobs are also hanging in the balance here, too. And I'm not suggesting that that's the only thing that these administrators care about, but we can't pretend like that's not also part of it when they're making all these decisions.
Well, and in modern colleges, of course, donors have so much sway. And you've seen a lot of prominent donors come out and say, you got to get these kids off campus because I don't agree with what they're doing and I'll withhold my funds.
100%.
You've been at multiple campuses now. I mean, what's your sense of what students are saying in response to these sorts of tactics?
It's a lot of talking past each other, which I think is kind of understandable whenever you've seen people who are very solidly rooted in their political leanings and what they believe. We've seen a lot of growing organization within the demonstrations itself so that they have spokespeople within the encampments. It's not kind of a free-for-all. There's a lot of conversations, Brad, between the demonstrators themselves and people on the outside who might disagree with them. There's a lot of accusations in both directions about agitators, about who is making things dangerous, about who is trying to make who look bad.
Oh, like nobody here said something anti-Semitic. It was that other guy who was trying to make us all look bad, that kind of a thing.
Exactly. Or you're coming here to antagonize us so that we can get mad. That way you could film it and try to use it. And those allegations go both directions, Brad. I mean, this weekend at UCLA, we had a pro-Israel demonstration that was separated by some barriers from the encampment.
There are dividers for a reason. We're respecting yours. You respect ours.
The demonstrators, of course, turn their focus towards each other, and you get a few people who break through the barriers. You've got a couple violent altercations, but in general, you got a lot of videos coming out from both sides saying, look at how the other side is trying to aggravate us.
Radical Islam is oppressive. Show your face, lady. Are you a coward?
I had an Israeli flag wrapped around me, and I stayed silent. All I wanted to do was sit there and listen and show what I stood for, and people walked up to me. They called me racist. They called me a terrorist. I was called a pig at one point.
It's a lot of that. And then, like I said before, this is not the vast majority of any college campus that is out there. The point of the protest is to disrupt the status quo.
Divestment, disclosure, amnesty.
Much of the universities are still going about the status quo. You have people who are still going to class. You have people that are preparing for their finals, that are ready for commencement. It doesn't mean that they stand for or against the demonstrations, but they are going about their business. And of course, looming over all of it, Brad, we hear from people on every single side of this issue who say that they don't feel safe. And some people, they don't feel safe because of the demonstrations. Some people, they don't feel safe because of the police response to the demonstrations.
We're really hurt by the way that the university brutalized our students, sent them to jail.
But certainly, however this ends up concluding at these universities, a lot of these students, their lives are about to be very different because of the consequences of what they're doing right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we're in the year 2024. Like, graduating college, for many people, for many Americans, that is the ticket to the rest of your life. So huge consequences here. And this question of what crosses the line from free speech into intimidation, and what line is this campus going to accept? All right, Trevor Ault covering all this. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, the most consequential criminal case in the country might have somehow become even more important. We'll tee up the Trump trial after the break.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
There are currently four criminal cases pending against former President Donald Trump, and any one of them could conceivably land him in prison. And yet in recent weeks, it's become more and more unlikely that most of them will even go to trial this year. For example, in Fulton County, Georgia, the case over election interference is a complicated one involving RICO statutes. Plus, it's been shaken up so much by a relationship between the DA and a former prosecutor that it's difficult to see any smooth sailing into trial. In Florida, a federal judge has seemed in no hurry to press ahead quickly with a case about classified documents. And last week in Washington, the Supreme Court signaled that it might send key questions about Jack Smith's case revolving around January 6th back down to a lower court, almost ensuring that takes months to get off the ground. So while you got four cases, it's very likely that only one of them will yield a jury verdict before Election Day. The Manhattan DA's charges against Trump for allegedly falsifying documents around hush money payments could be the defining case of this year, and today kicks off week two of testimony. So let's get you teed up. We got ABC's investigative reporter Olivia Rubin, who's been in court for all this so far. So Olivia, first off, can you just break down the testimony we've heard so far?
So it's been 4 days of testimony, Brad, three witnesses, but it already has felt like a lifetime inside of that courtroom. Prosecutors have started putting on their case against Donald Trump, and they started with a witness that many people likely haven't heard of unless they've been following closely. That's David Pecker. So he was the head of the publisher of the National Enquirer. And essentially what prosecutors allege, remember, is that this was a hush money plot, that Donald Trump, his lawyer Michael Cohen, worked with David Pecker to make sure that negative stories about him before the 2016 election did not come out. They said it was an election conspiracy. And then that is what later led to the charges of the way that Donald Trump and Michael Cohen hid these payments to one of the women, Stormy Daniels. So David Pecker is the state's case witness in chief. And what he did was sort of peel back this curtain into what he testified was an agreement between his magazine and Donald Trump to make sure that these stories never came out. He walked the jury painstakingly through his conversations with Donald Trump, his conversations with his team, his conversations on how to pay for stories such as a doorman selling a story that Donald Trump had fathered a child with a maid in Trump Tower.
Well, and my manager, I had heard some stories in the building about who she was, and then my manager confirmed that.
They paid $30,000 to make sure that that story did not come to light before the 2016 election and hurt the campaign.
What were these stories?
That she and Trump, she was Trump's housekeeper, and that they had a child together.
And this was critical testimony for the prosecution to get in, because remember, this is a case about falsifying business records, but what prosecutors are saying, can't emphasize it enough, this was an election interference case. So they got David Pecker on the stand to say, I hid these stories so it wouldn't hurt Donald Trump's campaign.
Yeah, that seems super key, Olivia, because the doorman story, like that had apparently been discredited before it was even bought. But is Pecker actually able to corroborate, yeah, this was all for the election? This wasn't like something he wanted to keep from his wife or the broader public or whatever.
Well, you must be in the minds of the prosecutors, because that's exactly what they asked him. They said, did you ever hear Donald Trump talk about how worried he was that these stories would affect his family? And David Pecker repeatedly said, no, we talked about the campaign. I hid these stories so it wouldn't affect the campaign. But of course, Donald Trump's attorneys had their crack at him as well. And what they said was, this was just business as usual. This is what a tabloid does with a politician. They called it standard conduct. Mm. And they tried to, Brad, bring it away from the election. They said that you've had a decades-long relationship with Donald Trump. Actually, the first time that you tried to alert him of a negative story was 17 years earlier on something about Marla Maples. This had nothing to do with the election. This is something that you did all the time. And on top of it, this is something you did with other people. Mm. They brought up instances where he killed stories for Rahm Emanuel, where he killed stories for Arnold Schwarzenegger. They tried to make it seem like this is just what happens. Do with it what you will. You may not like it, but it's not illegal.
Like, everyone's disgusting, and not even people who are running for president. Lots of people do this.
Exactly. This had nothing to do with the election. This is what powerful people do to protect their image, like it or not.
Right. And the reason that, again, it's so important that this is an election thing is because it's election finance forms that then you would have to file legally and have all the supporting documentation. Pecker, by the way, says this situation was unique. He hadn't done this with presidential candidates before. So what does that take us up to this week, Olivia? What's next post Pecker?
Court getting back underway today, and there's going to be a banker back on the stand. And I know it doesn't sound as interesting or as, you know, headline grabbing as David Pecker, head of the National Enquirer, talking about his meetings with Donald Trump in Trump Tower. But this banker, Gary Farrow, is speaking to his conversations with Michael Cohen and the work he did for Michael Cohen, setting up shell accounts so that these women could be paid, so that Stormy Daniels could be paid. But nonetheless, this is the paper trail that prosecutors need to get into the record. David Pecker told the story. Now Gary Farrow is on the stand talking about the nitty-gritty of how it was actually done. And that is critical information for prosecutors.
Hey, what's so bizarre to me, Olivia, is what happens every day when this defendant is leaving court, right? Because former President Trump has a gag order about talking smack about people involved with this case, and yet he seems to do just that all the time. So, like, you can't violate a gag order many times, right, without, like, landing yourself in contempt.
Well, we're going to see exactly where he does land himself, and think about it. Prosecutors first said Donald Trump violated the gag order 7 times. Now we're up to 14 alleged violations.
Well, Michael Cohen is a convicted liar, and he's got no credibility whatsoever.
And prosecutors have asked the judge to hold Donald Trump in contempt and to impose financial penalties. So it's really all eyes on Judge Marchand on what he is going to do with these alleged gag order violations. And he did hold a hearing on the issue earlier, and it did not go well for Donald Trump's team. And so if you go based just on that hearing, it does not look like it's going to be good for Donald Trump in terms of the ruling on this gag order.
But what would you do, Olivia, if you found him guilty of violating the gag order? Because I guess the first step would usually be fines, but eventually, what, are you going to You going to send the former president to jail, like, during the trial? Because that gets out of hand very quickly for a judge.
If you want to say, you know, we were already in unprecedented territory, talk about the fact that there's this new reporting from the team that the Secret Service is preparing and having conversations for what to do should Donald Trump be held in contempt and sentenced to some sort of confinement. You know, it's not does he get convicted and go to jail. It's does he get put in a cell of some sorts. Now, of course, prosecutors have said that they are not seeking jail time for Donald Trump, but just the fact that Secret Service is having to go through these conversations and prepare for it underscores the gravity of the situation and highlights just how unprecedented this really is. And I also would just say, Brad, not many people have been inside of that courthouse, and just from going there every single day, it is not a pleasant place. It is not a place that Donald Trump wants to be every day, and it is certainly not a place where he wants even the shred of possibility that he could be put in some sort of holding cell. That courtroom is old. That courtroom is unkept. It is not somewhere where you could ever imagine a former president of the United States.
Absolutely bonkers that you're even describing. Like, this is maybe where they would put the former president in jail for a day or two or whatever a judge would impose. Olivia Rubin, going back to court today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, if you thought baseball made bold fashion choices with pinstripes, wait until you see the pants that fall apart. One last thing is next.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
And one last thing. They thought the transition to new uniforms would be seamless. They were wrong.
Major League Baseball is striking out with its new uniforms. For many players, they're not even in the ballpark.
If you follow baseball, you might have heard that during spring training, players were grumbling about their new unis. For the first time, instead of being made by this specialty shop in Pennsylvania, all Major League uniforms would be designed by Nike, which were immediately ripped online by fans.
The new pants are 100% see-through.
You can see the Nike logo of this guy's, like, spandex under his pants.
First off, the material is thinner, which is meant to be more breathable on hot summer days. But several players have gotten holes in their pants after sliding, and many fans noticed they could see right through to the players' undergarments.
Instead of talking about Ohtani and Soto and baseball, we're talking about what the players look like naked!
Then there were the names and numbers. See, classic uniforms had the names embroidered on them. Nike wanted them printed on, again, to make them lighter, but now fans say they can't even read them from the stands. One player griped that it feels like a Little League uniform. It feels cheap. When players wear their traditional road grays now, the pants and shirts sometimes don't match color, and sometimes players sweat through them, leaving grody stains. Well, yesterday, our partners at ESPN obtained a memo from the Major League Baseball Players Union to its players, informing them that changes are coming.
The memo said, at its core, what has happened here is that Nike was innovating something that didn't need to be innovated.
Letters will once again be bigger, sweat hopefully won't be as noticeable. What's more, and this is what surprised a lot of baseball folks, was this memo absolutely threw Nike under the bus, saying of the multiple companies involved, quote, "This has been entirely a Nike issue," end quote. Nike hasn't commented, nor has Major League Baseball itself, but the Players Union told its members here that Nike has committed to making significant changes by next year, which has elicited reactions like, wait, next year?
We're talking about baseball uniforms. We're not talking about portrait gallery oil paintings here. You can make 1,000 of these in a day. You can make 5,000 of these in a day.
Now, there are a lot of issues to address. Reportedly, zippers aren't even working so great in the pants. But as all these problems pile up, that also makes you wonder if players can even make it to October fully clothed. The best part of this is they were sold as, like, higher performance. You guys would be higher performance with these on. Now, all these dudes look less athletic than ever because, like, by the second inning, they all look like they're sweating through their uniforms. It's disgusting. I'm so glad that I work off camera. Hey, if you're enjoying the show, make sure to leave a rating and review wherever you listen. It truly does help us out. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
get the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.